Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. China called it Black Monday, but how worried should we be? With the recovery from the 2008 crash still far from complete, can the world take another financial crisis? Also this week, after 40 economists write to the Observer demanding a fair hearing for Jeremy Corbyn's prospectus, we speak to Richard Murphy, who's an advisor to the Labour frontrunner. And with dozens of freshly minted peers heading for the Lords, we'll hear from a constitutional expert about what that's going to mean for the balance of power in the second chamber. Joining me this week, we've got the Guardian economics editor, Larry Elliott, our columnist Seamus Milne, and down the line from Westminster, Rowena Mason. A warm welcome to you all. Now, billions of dollars were wiped off the value of shares this week around the world as the Chinese stock market dived and spread fear everywhere. Larry, you compared it to the Wall Street crash in one of your pieces this week in 1929. How worried should we be? Is it back to 2008?
It could be. The comparison I made with the Wall Street crash was that after 2 days of falls on the Wall Street crash, the market picked up, and that sort of happened this week. The same sort of pattern always arises. So I was just warning people not to get complacent when the market rallied, which it subsequently has. I think that there are two issues here. One is that we tend to have a financial crisis every 8 or 9 years. Since about 1972, that's happened, you know, early 1970s, early 1980s, late 1980s, late 1990s, late 2000s. So historically, we're due one. And the second thing that worries me is the fact that China itself looks to me as though it's doing much less well than the official figures suggest, probably having a hard landing in China. And the third thing is, and there's no guarantee that the problems in China will export themselves to Britain. In some respects, what's happening in China will be good news for Britain because it will mean lower energy prices, lower prices in the shops. But if China does export a recession to the rest of the world, we are not in a position really to manage it in the way we were in 2008. At that time, interest rates were 5% and could be cut. This time, there's 0.5 and can't be cut. At that time, the budget deficit was pretty small and could be expanded without too much problem. We'd had no QE. All the normal ammunition and a bit of the abnormal ammunition of central banks has already been fired. So if this does turn nasty, you have to ask yourself, what policy response is there? And just doing more QE, which is probably going to be the natural response, is not an answer, because actually what's happened over the last 6 or 7 years is that loads of QE has boosted asset prices everywhere in the world, including China, and we're now seeing the consequences of that. As soon as policymakers say we're not going to do any more QE or we're going to raise interest rates, the bottom falls out of the financial markets. Central banks then have to sort of say, okay, in that case, we'll scrap plans to raise interest rates and we might do a bit more QE. So essentially just keep feeding the beast.
So there might be a crisis, and if there is, we're absolutely sunk, in summary, seems to be what Larry's saying. Seamus, you've been rather more sanguine about how the depth of this crisis, or at least about China's ability to handle it.
Yeah, I mean, I basically agree with what Larry said. It's just that I think the Chinese stock market is very well, it's much smaller than the comparable stock markets in the West. It's quite well insulated from the Chinese economy because the Chinese economy is dominated by state-owned banks and enterprises. And some of the normal mechanisms that would feed in from a stock market crash in the West into wider economic downturn don't exist in China and can be overcome more easily. China's clearly slowing, and that has an impact globally, but it's partly the response to lower demand in the rest of the world. And I think that's, I mean, as Larry says, I think the key point is that the 2008 crisis and its aftermath is not fixed in the rest of the world, particularly in Europe and even in North America, which is supposed to be one of the star performers. But I mean, China's, even if it's got lower growth figures than people say, it's still more than double the growth rate of Britain or the United States. But, you know, we have very, very serious inbuilt weaknesses and structural problems in the post-2008 Western economies. They're not fixed. There's the asset prices have been boosted up and pumped up by QE and cheap credit again. But actually, what's really happening is that and the reason why interest rates are at rock bottom is because, you know, the private sector is simply not investing here or in Europe or in North America at anything like the rate that you would want to see a real economy on the a real recovery in the traditional mold. So, you know, this is the slowest recovery in 200 or 300 years, depending how you measure it. And I think, you know, with this kind of financial instability that's been pumped up all over the world, you know, you're likely to see that here rather than in China feeding into the real economy. So I think it's not unreasonable to expect there to be another downturn in the next few years, which obviously has political implications here and elsewhere.
Rowena, I mean, the last election in many ways was about this sense that Osborne and Cameron were the men who had a plan, and the plan had half worked, maybe. But this obviously could potentially throw it very much off track right at the beginning of their first term. Do you think that's what MPs are thinking about, or are they just worrying about the latest froth on, I don't know, immigration figures or whatever today's story happens to be?
No, I think George Osborne and his Conservative MPs are very aware that they're on politically quite dangerous ground at the moment, because the election, their whole argument was trying to pin responsibility for the last crash on Labour, and saying that, you know, just because Labour were holding the keys to the car when it crashed, it was all their fault. They could find themselves in exactly the same position this time round if there is another downturn on their watch, and it would be quite difficult for them to wriggle out of responsibility and just and blame kind of international forces beyond their control, when that's exactly the argument that they had against Labour.
And so they are worried, but I imagine they're thinking at the moment they're still in charge of all they survey on the political front.
Yeah, and George Osborne's tone when he's been talking about what's happening in China is very, very much trying to say that he's confident that there's going to be no immediate sharp problems, and he says that the UK is not immune, but we've just got to continue to trade with China and keep our house in order. So he's taking a very calm and measured tone, as you would expect him to. He obviously doesn't want to stoke any fear, but underneath all that, I imagine he's probably pretty worried.
Well, one person who's certainly worried about the prospects of the Osborne plan is Jeremy Corbyn. His radical prospectus, nicknamed Corbynomics, is becoming a little bit clearer, and one of its architects is the tax campaigner Richard Murphy.
Corbynomics is based upon a number of ideas which, I accept, have been promoted on my blog over the last few years. The one that is most identifiable is people's quantitative easing, and you have to get used to the number of T's in that. And then the second one is about progressive taxation. The third one is about trying to close the tax gap to create a level playing field for British business.
One of the, in the election that's just gone, obviously the public, maybe a bit reluctantly, but certainly did return a government whose big argument is you can't spend money you haven't got. Economists can pick holes in that, but how do you think you could make a pitch that argues that you could do something different from imposing the sort of cuts that they're talking about then?
Well, first of all, let's dispute that point that governments can't spend money they haven't got. Governments create money. All money, whether it is created by governments or by banks, is created out of thin air through the process of lending. All deposits are created as a consequence of lending and not the other way around. This is something that the Bank of England finally admitted in April 2014. So the government has got all its monetary theory wrong. And if you accept that the government can create money, and of course it can and does, deficit spending does create money. And in fact, if there was no deficit spending, there wouldn't be no government created money in the economy. Then in fact, we're in the position that we don't have to live by this rule if we have to balance the books. That's a totally appropriate rule for households. It's a totally appropriate rule for corporations, because if either of those let their debts run out of control, they will go bust. But they can't print money, governments can. Governments have the duty to actually create the money that is needed to promote a full employment economy where people are actually able to work to fulfill their potential, so long as they don't create inflation. Now, you can't create inflation if you have underused resources in the economy. We have massive underused resources in our economy right now. They're called people. They're either unemployed or they're underemployed. And the underemployment is either through false self-employments, people who simply aren't registering as unemployed at all anymore, or people who are working at very low levels of productivity. All of those need to be addressed. If the private sector will not take action to correct this, then if it's withdrawing from economic activity, the government has no choice but take its place.
Larry, people's quantitative easing, it might sound to the untutored ear like a licence to spend whatever you like. Can it be made to add up economically?
Yeah, I think it can in the right circumstances. I think people's QE is a very good policy in the right circumstances. Those circumstances would be when the economy is in serious trouble, when you've used up all the normal policy tools, when interest rates are at zero, as they are now, when you've tried ordinary QE, which effectively means buying bonds from the private sector and exchanging them for money, which you then hope is going to trickle down to the economy. That hasn't worked too well. And in those circumstances, if the economy now did tank, policymakers would be faced with a real dilemma as to what to do. And one option would be so-called helicopter money, whereby pretty much the George Osborne writes a cheque to every member of the public and invites them to go out and spend it. In the UK's case, perhaps not a great idea, given that we've got a whopping great balance of payments deficit and we've got always had a massive propensity to import and to consume more than we produce. And
spend it on pulling China out of its slump.
Well, exactly. But, exactly. So we could import loads more Chinese stuff. Or you could say in those circumstances, we'll have an alternative to helicopter money, which is what people's QE effectively is. It's a way of printing money, but using it for perhaps better long-term purposes, such as mending Britain's infrastructure or investing in schools and hospitals or green infrastructure. And in those circumstances, yes, people's QE seems to me to be a perfectly valid policy tool. Where I would have problems with it is if it was used by a government on a regular basis as an alternative to borrowing money in order to fund infrastructure in the normal way.
And he's making this argument now in 2015 when the economy's not exactly racing ahead, but nor is it said to be in a recession and unemployment's relatively low. Bad time or good time to be making this argument?
Well, it really depends on what sort of people's QE Jeremy Corbyn's talking about. To be fair to him, he hasn't actually specified when he would be prepared to use it. I think he needs to be quite clear about that. And if he says quite candidly, this is a fallback position if things get really nasty, and things do get really nasty, which as we've just been saying, they well might, then he looks pretty good, I think. If he's saying we're going to use people's QE as a day-to-day policy tool to fund public spending and force the Bank of England in order to do that, and if the Bank of England governor doesn't like what he's being told he can ship off back to Canada, then I think that is a political problem and an economic problem, because I don't actually think people's QE is necessary in normal times. And I think for Corbyn, it would be politically disastrous for him to be seen as someone who wants to give the governor of the Bank of England his cards if he doesn't do what he's told by whoever a Labour chancellor might be. That, I think, would be politically naive. To be fair to Corbyn, I don't think he's actually specified when he would use people's QE, but I think he probably does need to specify pretty soon.
Do you agree with that? I mean, can you see big political risks here?
No, I don't think so. I think the central focus of what is called Corbynomics is the fact that public investment has to be raised very substantially to get this economy back into a genuine growth path, a sustainable growth path, and do the rebalancing which has been talked about for the last 5 or 6 years, and nothing whatever has happened about. If there's going to be a real recovery, public investment has to be at the heart of it. That's why the issue of public ownership is also important. But exactly how that public investment is financed, how a new national investment bank would work, that's something that, there's lots of technicalities about it, lots of issues around it. But as Larry says, what is called people's QE is about, instead of pumping huge amounts of liquidity into the private sector through the banks, which is then used to pump up asset prices, it's about driving those same resources into exactly what's needed in Britain, which is to raise the whole rate of investment. The rate of investment is incredibly low in Britain. That's the reason why productivity is low and why we're not going to grow at the rate we need to. So it's about, driving that not only infrastructure, but through, driving lending and as a motor of investment in the whole economy. So, as Larry says, Corbyn hasn't committed to this particular mechanism at any particular time. He's raised it as a possible way of financing large-scale public investment, and I think it's a sound one. And the question is, you know, as with a lot of the things that Corbyn has said, you know, if you listen to it closely and if you look at what is actually written in the documents, these are proposals or sometimes suggestions or even ideas that he's floating. But his whole idea and stance is to say we need to revive Labour Party democracy. This needs to be discussed by the whole party. And so these are my proposals or some of my ideas, but we need to involve the whole party in building them up and developing them as you know, long-term, medium-term policy.
Rowena, I suppose if you think of it from the point of view of an MP trying to explain things on the doorstep, it would give them something distinctive and different to say. But how many of them do you think would be enthusiastic about making this pitch?
Yeah, I think that's right. There is an element of, well, MPs have been asking for a long time for some more bold and radical things that they're able to say to people on the doorstep. One thing I do wonder about it when they're explaining, trying to explain quantitative easing to people that they meet in the street is, does it sound like a little bit too good to be true, maybe, to the average punter? You know, this idea that, you know, if an MP is trying to explain it in layman's terms, printing money, does, you know, aren't people going to question that as something that sounds a little bit like a fairy tale?
I mean, it would sound much more like a fairy tale if it hadn't been done on an absolutely huge scale by this government and the previous one. So this printing money, i.e. creating money electronically and then feeding it through the bond market, is what Britain's done, what the United States have done, what the European Union, the Eurozone is now doing. So it's not as if it's a new thing, but I agree with Rowena. I mean, because it's complicated and sounds weird, it's not easy to get across.
Isn't there a point here, Larry, about, I mean, one reason why governments have normally fine-tuned the economy with interest rates or quantitative easing, whatever, so-called monetary policy, is because actually they can credibly say, yeah, we'll turn that on and off. Whereas a Jeremy Corbyn-led government saying, now the economy's humming on all cylinders, so we're going to dramatically scale back on public spending or public investment. Is that something you could imagine?
I mean, I think that there are two good ideas that Corbyn has got, which are being muddled up. I support the idea of a national investment bank. I think that's quite a good plan, and I think people's QE in the right circumstances is a good emergency tool. I think what's happening here potentially is that the two things are being melded together, and I don't think that would be a good idea, because I think you'd end up perhaps with national investment policy, your infrastructure policy, starting to muddy the waters of your overall macroeconomic policy or demand management policy, and you might end up with the economy having too much investment or too little investment, depending on the state of the economy. I just think that we'd end up with two separate policies becoming blurred. And I think politically, I think the problem for Corbyn is going to be pretty much the one that Rowena talked about, that when he wins, which I expect he will, there is going to be a massive attempt to destroy his credibility. I mean, the reason Labour lost the last election was that it didn't really have any real economic credibility. And there will be an attempt to destroy Corbyn's credibility straight away. And the argument will be, here he is, this bearded lefty from Islington, who's always been a serial rebel, wants to sack the governor of the Bank of England, turn on the printing presses, create loads of inflation when the economy is doing okay, and turn Britain into Zimbabwe. That, you know, in a nutshell, is going to be the Tory onslaught on him. And he needs to be aware of that. I mean, I'm sure he is aware of that, and he needs to actually build some defences against it. And actually saying that you're going to, you know, toying with the idea that you're going to use print money as a way of actually funding investment programmes, when there's a perfectly normal and acceptable way of doing it. I mean, governments can borrow money because, you know, that's what governments could do.
At rock bottom rates.
So he's got a perfectly feasible fallback position, which is that, you know, for the last 6 or 7 years, interest rates have been at such low rates. Governments can borrow at, you know, very preferential rates of interest. They could afford to go out there, and if we said we needed a new motorway system or a new railway system, go out there and borrow the money. That's absolutely...
And do you think the markets would lend him the money as cheerfully as they will do Osborne Alistair Darling?
This goes back to the argument that the bond markets were freaking out in Britain in 2009-10 when the deficit was rising. They weren't. There was absolutely no evidence whatsoever, despite what George Osborne now says, that the bond markets were alarmed by Britain's 10 or 11% of GDP budget deficit. They realise that Britain is a, you know, has got its own currency, got its own central bank, and they realise that actually these were emergency levels of borrowing caused primarily by the recession and the fact that Britain was heavily exposed to the financial sector. So I think that they would, if it was a perfectly feasible plan and there were good projects that Corbyn wanted to invest in, Labour government wanted to invest in, yeah, I think that there would be no problem in the raising the money. Bond prices everywhere are very low. You know, the bond interest rates on government bonds are low across the entire world. That's the reality. They're not going to spike to 10% just because Jeremy Corbyn says he wants to electrify the West Coast Main Line or the, you know, it's absurd.
But this argument about, yeah, okay, this is acceptable because it's an emergency. That's the thing where I think he's vulnerable, Seamus, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting what Larry was saying because, of course, he's right. You know, the obvious way to, you know, drive up the rate of public investment is to borrow at incredibly low interest rates, which are available, and to do that. And this government, of course, or the coalition government cut public investment a lot. And that's one of the reasons the economy, the recovery is so weak and why, you know, productivity is so low, which is really an underlying issue which is rarely addressed. But I mean, one of the reasons I think, you know, there's sort of this attraction to people's QE in the way of framing the argument about public investment is precisely because borrowing has been toxified in the political culture. So the idea, the very sensible and rational approach, which is to borrow to invest, is a difficult political argument to make. And I think that's sort of found its way into the left of the Labour Party as well.
I think printing money to fund it is probably equally toxic, though. I mean, that's going to be an equally hard sell.
Yeah. It all sounds pretty tough to me, Rowena. But there again, I suppose if China goes as wrong as we were talking about at the top of the programme, then it could look quite good to have had a plan up your sleeve.
Yes, I think that's right. But who knows where the economic argument's going to move on if it, you know, with all this uncertainty. And what Jeremy Corbyn might have difficulty in persuading people is the sensibleness of trying kind of his new radical ideas as this is going to be portrayed against Osborne, who will sort of argue that he's continuity, safe pair of hands in a time of economic peril.
We should also just mention, of course, there are other still candidates running in the Labour leadership race, including Yvette Cooper, who's the only one who's a bona fide economist, as it were. Have any of the others said anything interesting on economics, do you think, Rowena?
Or anything?
Yvette Cooper's the one who has most directly argued against what Jeremy Corbyn is saying on people's quantitative easing, saying she doesn't think it's a very good idea. Chris Leslie, the acting shadow chancellor, has also said he thinks it's going to lead to higher inflation and interest rates. They're his sort of two main critics within the party.
And just bring us up to date with the ongoing saga of the race a bit more generally. There was a lot of talk about purges. There's talk now, isn't there, about canvas records being trawled through as we work out how hundreds of thousands of people voted and whether they're fit and proper Labour voters.
Yes, Labour's really got itself into a terrible pickle over who can and can't vote in this leadership election. And really, I think what it comes down to is that it's changed its tune going through this leadership election process quite a lot. Because at the beginning, Harriet Harman, the acting leader, was saying basically, you know, we welcome everybody, you know, anybody who wants to can sign up, pay £3 and get a vote and participate in our great new democracy that's coming to the Labour Party. And as time has gone on, the party seems to be getting more and more draconian about who actually supports its values, and it's doing all sorts of checks now under pressure from the non-Jeremy Corbyn candidates just to make sure that people aren't infiltrators. And really, there's only a very small number of people they've identified as being Tories or supporters of other parties, something like 0.5%. But it seems to be sort of all a part of an ongoing effort to sort of cast doubt and credibility on the robustness and integrity of the contest.
Oh, you think it's that? You think it's rather than actually an attempt at this late stage to affect the result, you think it's about delegitimising it before it arrives?
I think that's one argument. on the other side, it is possible that Andy Burnham and Yvette Cooper still think they're in with a chance of winning, and that even these very, very small numbers of infiltrators could possibly affect the result. But if you believe the polls, I'm not saying we necessarily should, but if we do, Jeremy Corbyn's so far out in ahead that really the number of infiltrators they found is not going to affect it.
I mean, there are ironies here, aren't there? Because it was meant to be about drawing people to the Labour Party who didn't like the Labour Party before. And so when is that legitimate, if someone used to vote Green or, for that matter, Conservative, and comes and joins the Red Army to have their say on the new chief? And when is it illegitimate, Seamus?
Yeah, I think Rowena's right. They've got themselves in a complete pickle about it. And really what it's about is the attempt to stop Corbyn winning. I mean, there was an obvious way to, you know, set up an easy test, which would have been, if the question for the registered supporters had been, are you a member of an organisation or a party that stands candidates against the Labour Party? And if you are, you can't vote. But if not, you can, and you say you support Labour values, you can vote. That would have been a very simple and uncontroversial test. But because it's actually, the question is more muddy, it's opened the door to this, what is effectively a sort of political test, which is being applied in different areas in different ways. And so, as Raina says, you know, you've got a very, very small group of people who are actually members of other parties, less 3,000 or fewer. But you're now then, in some areas, then are trying to extend it to loads of other people. And of course, that's going to be very controversial. I think the main thing that's happened is it's being seen as a discrediting the process. And of course, that is the intention of some people who feel that they're going to lose.
Do you think it make any odds, Larry?
No, I think Corbyn. Well, I don't think it'll make any difference to the result. I think Jeremy Corbyn's going to win by an absolute mile because he's the only one of the candidates who's saying anything distinctive to a Labour audience. I mean, whether that will appeal to a wider audience remains to be seen. But I think he is actually saying some interesting things, and that's why he's getting a response. I mean, I think Labour could end up with the worst of all possible worlds. If they're trying to stop Corbyn, it won't do that. But if they're trying to tarnish, it will certainly tarnish the process. So you'll end up with, you know, and there will be no, I doubt whether there'll be a legal challenge to it. So all it's done is actually make Labour look incompetent or slightly sort of, underhand in the way it's doing it. But it won't actually stop the result. So you end up with the worst of all possible worlds, I think.
Rowena, finally, as the kind of spotlight moves onto this unlikely figure, we're having kind of off-the-cuff remarks about things like women-only train carriages suddenly kind of make the news in a way that Jeremy Corbyn will have never experienced before. How given is he to kind of, you know, gaffes or saying things that, wouldn't matter if he was just a backbench MP, but sure as hell will now?
I think that remains to be seen, probably. I mean, this thing about the women-only train carriages is probably, I think you could probably call it a bit of a gaffe. It's probably the first one of the contest that we've really had. But he hasn't been tested that much in terms of, doing very big press conferences with a lot of angry and aggressive journalists. He hasn't done kind of very long, extended interviews with broadcasters, all the kinds of things he's going to have to do as the probable leader of the opposition. So we don't really know yet, I think, is the answer.
Well, there's going to be a lot more scrutiny of Jeremy for many weeks to come on theguardian.com/politics.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When it's time to create a website for whatever's newsworthy in your life, whether that's a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or just a blog, go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Now it's that time in the cycle where the Prime Minister gets to appoint a new batch of peers to the House of Lords. But what exactly are the rules? Earlier I caught up with Britain's foremost expert on the Second Chamber, Professor Meg Russell of the Constitution Unit at UCL.
Well, the basic rule is there are no rules, and that's the problem. There's a degree of vetting of people who go in, and there's been some controversy about that with respect to certain people being blocked. But that's really just about the financial probity of the candidates who are put forward. Beyond that, the House of Lords Appointments Commission has no control whatsoever over the suitability of candidates, whether they've got adequate qualifications, whether they're going to make a good contribution. But more crucially, it's got no control over the number who are put in, the timing of appointments or the balance between the political parties. So the rumours that we're hearing are that Cameron wants to appoint a large number of Conservatives because he wants to rebalance towards his party. There's nothing to stop him appointing as many as he wants whenever he wants, basically. And the unregulated system is the big problem which is leading to this rapid increase in size of the chamber. It's gone up enormously since Cameron became Prime Minister.
People like you at the Constitution Unit talk about an uncodified constitution, but here you're talking about a corner of the constitution that is absolutely make it up as you go along, as I understand it, both in terms not only of who's in this House, but of how many people are in this House. So how many people are going to be in the Lords roughly once this is all done? And how does that compare with back 15 years ago, the last time there was a big reform in the House of Lords?
Well, it was a reform in 1999 to remove the majority of hereditary peers, which brought the size of the chamber down a lot. It brought it down to about 660. We don't know yet how many appointments there are going to be today, but people are talking about 40 or 50. This will bring the equivalent number up to something like 860. So an increase of 200 members in 15 years. Now, 15 years, Cameron, of course, has only been Prime Minister for five of those years, but about two-thirds to three-quarters of the increase has been on his watch. So over the 11 years of Labour government, there was an increase of about 40 or 50. Now, that was regrettable. People thought that Tony Blair put in too many peers. People complained about the level of Tony Blair's peerage appointments. But Cameron has appointed faster than Blair. In the last 5 years, the size of the chamber has increased by about 120 or 130. The unwritten constitution element, I think it depended on, to a degree, prime ministerial restraint. I mean, there have been times in history, around the 1909 crisis over the people's budget, around the Great Reform Act in 1832, when there was talk of flooding the House of Lords with hundreds of peers for the government to get something through. That never actually happened. Those threats never happened. But we're coming closer to that now than we ever have done. I mean, Cameron has appointed at a faster rate than any other prime minister since 1958. And it seems to me quite extraordinary that this is a Conservative prime minister who is doing enormous reputational damage to the House of Lords. It gets in the newspapers now for all the wrong reasons. It's all about size and number of appointments. It's making it harder and harder for the House of Lords to do its job of holding the government to account. The place is overcrowded, the costs are going up, and effectively, I think, we're seeing a Conservative Prime Minister who's in danger of destroying the House of Lords, which is quite a strange thing.
Let's just talk for a minute about this point that's the Conservative point today about party balance. Obviously, the Conservatives won the election, and the Liberal Democrats did very badly, and the Liberal Democrats have got quite a big group. Have the Conservatives at least got an argument that they deserve to put in some extra peers because they're underrepresented? And what about the minor parties that got such a big vote share in the election? How do they do in the House of Lords?
In answer to your first question, do the Conservatives have a right to do this because they're underrepresented? I would say, frankly, no. The Conservatives won the general election, yes, but they won it relatively narrowly. Cameron has a majority of 12 in House of Commons. Look back to Blair's landslide majority in 1997. Blair appointed a lot of people on the Labour and Liberal Democrat sides. He did it quite rapidly because the place at the time was dominated by Conservatives. It was 9 years after Blair became Prime Minister until Labour was larger in the Lords than the Conservatives. Now, David Cameron has inherited a chamber where the Conservatives are already the largest party, thanks to his appointments in the last Parliament. So I think he's got no justification whatsoever for strengthening the Conservative side. Tony Blair was able to live with a House of Lords which was more Conservative than Labour for 9 years. The sky didn't fall in. He didn't lose his big bills. He had to negotiate over the detail of quite a lot of policy. Ministers had to defend policy in front of a chamber where they didn't have a majority. That is healthy for democracy. It's healthy for Parliament that ministers have to explain themselves, justify their policies, and negotiate their way through. Cameron doesn't seem prepared to do that. He was rather spoilt under coalition. Because, of course, the Liberal Democrats in the Lords were mostly voting for his legislation, and now they're not. So he's obviously feeling the pain. But what he doesn't realise is that under coalition, he had a much easier time than Blair or Brown ever did when they were in government. In terms of the minor parties, I think there is a valid point there. There are no rules. the Prime Minister decides the party balance. If there were rules, they would surely take into account in some way proportionality of votes cast. So you would see more, well, the SNP don't want to take seats, but you'd see SNP people. If they wanted the seats, you'd see more Plaid Cymru people, you'd see more Greens, and uncomfortably for some, you'd also see more UKIP. Mm.
There was meant to be a big plan for Lords reform in the last Parliament, Meg, and it crashed and burned. But there was some reform, wasn't there? David Steele, the former Liberal leader, did some kind of a reform. Wasn't that meant to give people a way to retire and so on? Shouldn't that stop this place creaking at the seams?
There was a private members bill in the last Parliament which allows people to retire voluntarily from the Lords. I mean, that's a sensible small step. But the answer to this overcrowding problem is not for people to leave, it's to stop the incoming flood. In a way, if people left, it would simply free up more space and give the Prime Minister more opportunity to flood the place with his people. My advice to the Lords actually has been to not make a big move on retirement until there's some deal on the way in. And I think there is a deal to be struck whereby limits are put on the power to appoint, and at the same time there's an agreement on something like a retirement age. But until there's a limit on the way in, allowing people to leave would just mean the most experienced members departing and room for more sort of former political advisers and so on who are in hock to the Prime Minister to come in.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Larry, to Seamus and to Rowena. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.